The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the Annals of Medicine Department of the June 2, 2025 issue of the New Yorker. The radical development of an entirely new painkiller. The opioid crisis has made it even more urgent to come up with novel approaches to treating suffering. Finally, there's something effective. By Rivka Galkin. Pain might flicker, flash, prickle, drill, lancinate, pinch, cramp, tug, scald, sear, or itch. It might be blinding or grueling or annoying, and it might, additionally, radiate, squeeze, or tear with an intensity that is mild, distressing, or excruciating. Yet, understanding someone else's pain is like understanding another person's dream. The dreamer searches out the right words to communicate it. The words are always insufficient and imprecise. In 1971, the psychologist Ronald Melzack developed a vocabulary for pain to make communication less cloudy. His McGill Pain Questionnaire, versions of which are still in use today, comprises 78 words divided into 20 groups, with an additional 5 words to describe intensity and 9 to describe pain's relationship to time, from transient to intermittent to constant. Not included in the MPQ is the language that Friedrich Nietzsche used in describing the migraines that afflicted him. "I have given a name to my pain, and I call it dog. It is just as faithful, just as obtrusive and shameless, just as entertaining, just as clever as any other dog." Specific words for pain can correlate with the underlying causes of it, and different causes point to different approaches to relief. A steroid injection might help with a slipped disc, Tylenol with injuries from a fall, a dark room with a migraine, and a hot water bottle with a stomachache. Unless the stomachache is caused by appendicitis, which calls for a more radical remedy. The ancients had as wondrous and occasionally questionable a mixture of notions as we have, and also knew, as we do, that not all pains respond to the same remedies. Dioscorides of Anazarbus, a first century Greek physician, recommended treating hip pain with mountain goat droppings on oil-soaked wool. For anesthesia, he suggested boiled mandrake root or memphitic stone, and for migraines, an unguent of roses applied to the temples and forehead. Pliny reported the use of a mole's tooth as an aid for human toothache. Some 1,800 years later, Nietzsche had his migraines treated with leeches applied to his ears. These remedies were imperfect, and the path to finding them was uncertain. In the 19th century, pain and fever were treated with sodium salicylate, but the drug could cause nausea and a ringing in the ears, so a chemist for Frederick Bayer and Company thought it would be worth trying variants on salicylic acid. He concocted acetylsalicylic acid that we call aspirin. Other painkillers followed more zigzagging paths. In 1886, two German physicians decided to try naphthalene as a treatment for a patient with worms and a fever. The worms were unfazed, but the fever dropped. The physicians discovered that the pharmacist had accidentally given them the wrong substance, the later identification of which led to the development of acetaminophen, or Tylenol. The common epilepsy drug, carbamazepine, was developed to treat the shooting nerve pain of trigeminal neuralgia, which is described as a feeling like a hatchet to the head and is often called the suicide pain. Physicians today have a number of ways of categorizing pain and its causes, and the categories often overlap. Rheumatoid arthritis is an example of inflammatory pain and also of chronic pain. Nerve damage or malfunction, like sciatica, is neuropathic pain, whereas the pain you appropriately feel when you close a door on your thumb is nociceptic pain. Surgery, broken bones, burns, that's acute pain. The pain associated with cancer and with cancer treatment is another category. It tends not to be sufficiently ameliorated by any available drugs, though the standard of care is to treat it with opioids. We have tended to get in trouble when we mismatch pains and painkillers. Opioids and opiates have been particularly vexed. Historians disagree about how long humans have been using opium. One relatively early data point comes from the 10th century Persian polymath Al-Razi. Quote, "I have heard amazing accounts, amongst which is the following. The physician prescribed for gout a potion prepared with 2 mithquals of colchicum, 1/2 dirham of opium, and 3 dirhams of sugar. This drug is said to be effective within the hour, but I need to verify this." Thomas De Quincey, the 19th century English essayist, famously offered a first-hand account of his laudanum addiction in The Confessions of an English Opium Eater. One chapter is titled The Pleasures of Opium, and another The Pains of Opium. He goes into the pains more extensively, the pleasures more seductively. Today, the opioids Percocet and Vicodin are often prescribed for acute pain, which they are very good at alleviating. They are also prescribed for chronic pain, which is estimated to affect around 50 million Americans. This is trickier. A meta-study has concluded that they aren't particularly helpful for such pain. They're also not much good for neuropathic pain. The not inconsequential effectiveness of placebos should be considered, too, when thinking about how best to treat pain. Patients in clinical trials are sometimes asked to keep a pain diary, and it turns out that the keeping of the diary itself can diminish the intensity of pain and improve one's mood. The risks of addiction and overdose make prescribing opioids not unlike sending someone home with a gun. More than 2 million people in the United States are believed to have an opioid use disorder. And last year, more than 50,000 died from overdoses. The risk of addiction for any particular person can't be confidently predicted, but studies show that some 7% of people who are prescribed opioids after an operation are still refilling their prescription 3 months later. Opioids are miserable in other ways. They leave users sleepy, confused, and constipated. But what else is there to give? The last 20 years have been quite depressing to be a pain researcher. Todd Bertok, an anesthesiologist who has overseen more than 150 clinical trials, told me, "Everybody was waiting for a magic non-opioid opioid, something that wasn't an opioid but behaved just like one. Now, at last, there is something substantially new." Jeff Woods, a clinical geneticist working at St. James University Hospital in Leeds, wasn't thinking about pain. It was the late 1990s, and he kept seeing a rare form of microcephaly, undersized heads, in Yorkshire's Pakistani immigrant community, most of whom came from Mirpur. Woods is now at Cambridge. They were always saying, "Oh, we've got a cousin back in Pakistan with the same condition," Woods told me. Woods knew that this suggested a genetic basis. If he could see the cousins, take their medical histories, speak with multiple family members, obtain blood samples, he would have a better chance of identifying the underlying genes. Woods started to spend a few weeks every year working in clinics in and around Mirpur and meeting with the extended families of his patients from Yorkshire. On one visit, doctors told him about a child who worried them. They suspected that he had a genetic condition, and they were curious to get Wood's opinion. The boy was well known as a street performer. He would stab his arms with a knife or walk on hot coals. And then he would come to casually, and they would patch him up, Woods recalled being told. He was usually brought in by his overwhelmed mother, who wished that she could talk some sense into him. The boy said that he couldn't feel pain. Woods agreed to see him on his next visit to Pakistan. Woods knew of cases of people who didn't feel pain, but those cases were marked by excessive sweating and increased infections. They seemed clinically different. He told me that, at the time, few researchers really believed that some people were simply born unable to feel pain. It would have sounded like a fable, or like the Grimm's fairy tale about the boy who didn't know fear. When Woods returned to Pakistan, the clinicians told him that the boy, on his 14th birthday, had jumped from the roof of a house to show off for his friends. He had been brought to the hospital unconscious and died a short time later. I think it was at that stage that it stopped being a mythical disease for me, Wood said. I hadn't got it that if you feel pain, well, there are some things you would normally not do because you know it's going to hurt. Now we know that there is a condition known as congenital insensitivity to pain. Woods met other people in the region who had experiences similar to those of the child who died. The boys, about half of them, end up killing themselves by their early 20s, just doing the craziest things that normally pain would have taught you not to do, he said. The girls are sensible. They are hypervigilant. They know they're at great risk of terrible problems and are very careful. Woods eventually discovered that all these people had mutations in the SCN9A gene, which is involved in the production of tiny passageways found in cell membranes, which regulate the flow of sodium ions into and out of cells, and are thus crucial in sending electrical signals. Nerves use such signals to communicate pain to your brain. Around the same time, Stephen Waxman, a professor of neurology, neuroscience, and pharmacology at Yale's Medical School, received a phone call about a neighborhood in Alabama where many people preferred to walk barefoot or wore open-toed sandals and liked stepping in cold puddles. Some of them said that their hands and feet felt like they were on fire, and that this was true of family members going back at least five generations. These people feel excruciating, burning, scalding pain in response to mild warmth, wearing a sweater, wearing shoes, going outside when it's 72 degrees Fahrenheit, Waxman told me. Their condition is known as inherited erythromelalgia, or man-on-fire syndrome. Waxman sent a team from his lab to Alabama to meet both affected and unaffected family members and to collect DNA samples. All the affected members and none of these unaffected ones had the same mutation of the SCN9A gene, the gene that Woods had identified as altered in the Pakistanis who couldn't feel pain. I assigned a team of skilled PhD physiologists who worked around the clock, trying to figure out what changes the mutation produced, Waxman recalled. The neuroscientist Suleiman Dibhaj, also at Yale, inserted the mutant SCN9A gene into neurons. The neurons were firing like a machine gun when they should have been silent, Waxman said. The sodium channels were too easily activated, and suddenly we knew why these people were on fire when they should be feeling mildly warm, Waxman said. The genetic mutation associated with inherited erythromelalgia is what is called a gain-of-function mutation. There can also be loss-of-function mutations. That's what the people who felt no pain had. Woods and Waxman's work suggested a potential target for a novel painkiller. Opioids target the parts of the brain that receive pain signals. A drug acting on sodium channels might mitigate the sending of pain signals. We know that in radios and computers, electricity is carried by electrons through wires, Chris Miller, a professor emeritus of biochemistry at Brandeis University, explained to me. In biological systems, it's carried by ions via ion channels. Miller has spent decades studying how the channels work. I don't really care what these molecules do for human health. I just find them such fascinating entities. A nerve spike will zoom down an axon to the tune of 100 meters per second, he said. He compared that with other bodily systems, like hormones, which affect changes over minutes to hours. It is only relatively recently that we began to understand in much detail how the channels in our nerves work. In August 1939, the British physiologist Alan Hodgkin and his student Andrew Huxley, Aldous's half-brother, examined squid giant axons, which are up to 1,000 times thicker than typical human nerve fibers, and thus easier to study. Hodgkin and Huxley used fine electrodes to look for voltage differences across axons, and within a few weeks had exciting preliminary results. But then Hitler invaded Poland. Their work was put on hold for about 7 years. Hodgkin's went into radar development. In 1946, before modern computers or microelectrodes, Hodgkin and Huxley designed clever experiments from a few basic measurements that allowed them to conclude that the nerve cells must have ion channels embedded in them, regulating the flow of current. We now know that there are channels specific to five kinds of ions: sodium, calcium, potassium, chloride, and hydrogen ions, that generate electrical signals in nerves and other cells. They couldn't see the channels, Waxman said with admiration. They had no idea of their structure. Yet they predicted their presence and their properties with great prescience. A decade earlier, an anesthetizing compound that acted on sodium channels had been found, though it wasn't understood that it was sodium channels it was acting on. Researching a mutated strain of barley, scientists at Stockholm University tried synthesizing substances that lent the plant pest resistance. The testing method was of its time. One of them tests a compound on his tongue, and his tongue goes numb. John Wood, a professor of molecular neurobiology at University College London, whom Woods describes as the doyen of sodium channels, told me. During the war, the Swedish anesthesiologist Torsten Gård ran a small trial using his medical students as subjects. As compensation, he offered them a choice of a copy of his PhD dissertation or a pack of cigarettes. Half the students were given the compound, half were given the placebo, and most took the cigarettes. The results were conclusive. The substance killed pain. That's the origin of lidocaine, Wood told me. It's a Swedish fairy tale. When applied locally, lidocaine was a marvelous anesthetic. It worked especially well for dental procedures, but if you took enough of it to knock out pain in your whole body, it could kill you. Post-war anesthesiologists and dentists knew not to give the drug systemically, but they didn't yet fully understand that it worked by acting on sodium channels, which are found in pain-sensing neurons, as well as in muscles in the heart and in the brain. Lidocaine blocks all the sodium channels everywhere in the body. Your heart muscles fail to contract, your brain goes quiet. Researchers realized that if you want to design a painkiller that you can administer systemically and safely, it needs to block only some kinds of channels and only in specific locations. The genetic mutations that the patients of both Waxman and Woods had affect a sodium channel called sodium V1.7, which is predominantly found in peripheral pain-sensing neurons. A drug interrupting pain signaling before it ever reached the brain would likely lack the addictiveness of opioids. We all went crazy because people without sodium V1.7 were pain-free but otherwise normal, Wood, the doyen of sodium channels, told me. It was unbelievably exciting. All that researchers had to do was to make a compound that affected only that sodium channel. Well, actually, that would be very difficult, but still. The genetic validation of sodium V1.7 was knock your socks off strong, Waxman said. Sodium V1.7 was the perfect target, but there's a catch in the story, Wood said. Waxman's lab started with a small trial of a drug that targeted the sodium V1.7 sodium channels. Five people with inherited erythromelalgia participated. We saw an encouraging response, Waxman recalled. The drug advanced to a trial involving dozens of patients with other conditions at multiple sites. But in the large trial, researchers did not see a signal of efficacy, Waxman said. It could be that the drug did block sodium V1.7 channels, but that the dose was insufficient, or that the drug didn't distribute to the right locations in the body, or that sodium V1.7 blocking worked on some forms of pain but not others. And there was yet another possibility. Pain is important for survival, so it makes sense that the mechanism of pain signaling has redundancy at the molecular level to make it robust, Bruce Bean, a sodium channel researcher at Harvard, told me. Sodium V1.7 was out of favor. But it wasn't the only promising sodium channel. A toxin found in the pufferfish, that marine creature that resembles a devilish massage therapy ball, affects 6 of the 9 known sodium channels. During their research into pain, Wood and his team discovered that mice, in which they had disabled the gene for sodium V1.8, a channel that the pufferfish toxin does not block, felt much less pain. The researchers were thrilled. They formed a company and quickly raised 8 million British pounds in support. But they, too, encountered difficulties. Wood said, "We were all set to go into toxicity studies, and then they ran out of money, then merged with another company, which also ran out of money. A further discouragement, by 2015, it became known that some people with Brugada syndrome, in which the heart may abruptly stop, had mutations in the gene that encodes sodium V1.8. It was not clear whether a substance that blocked sodium V1.8 would precipitate such a problem, but it was a serious concern. We thought, oh, that's no good, Wood said. Many researchers put sodium V1.8 behind them. But the cell biologist, Paul Negulescu, who had started looking into it in 1998, continued working. In college at Berkeley, Negulescu had initially studied history. Then, as a junior, I took a physiology class where a professor explained how the kidney worked, he told me. It was all about keeping sodium ions and chloride ions and potassium ions in balance. The kidney, a tremendously under-celebrated organ, basically does four-dimensional Sudoku with ions. I was just in awe of the genius of nature. It just clicked in my head, this is amazing, he said. He volunteered in an ion channel lab as an undergrad, and later, as a PhD student in physiology, collaborated with the professor on research. When the professor started a new company, Negulescu joined it, and in 2001 it was bought by Vertex Pharmaceuticals, where he is now a senior vice president. In 2019, Negulescu's team received FDA approval for Trikafta, a drug for cystic fibrosis which works on the faulty chloride channels responsible for the disease. A patient who starts taking the drug as a teenager has a life expectancy of more than 80 years. Nearly twice the span of someone whose disease is managed with supportive care treatments only. We like ion channels, Negulescu said. We think they're really good drug targets. They just require a lot of care and attention to how you measure them. The papers that Wood's team published on the role of the sodium V1.8 channel in pain signaling were a major inspiration for Negulescu to turn his attention to sodium channels and pain. Each sodium channel type has its own personality, he said. They open at different voltages. They remain open for different lengths of time. They evolve to perform in certain ways in certain tissues. Sodium V1.8 channels open and close up to 20 times a second. So we had to catch them in the act, he said. In trying to find a molecule that would inhibit sodium V1.8, one might surmise that likely compounds would have shapes similar to those of lidocaine or other anesthetics. But Negulescu said, we didn't want to rely only on our intuition about what chemical classes might work. So his team aimed to be agnostic, remaining open to unforeseen possibilities. This approach would not have been feasible even a few years earlier because of limits on how many lab tests could be done in a reasonable window of time. But Negulescu's team had developed a new technology that allowed them to screen compounds much more quickly. It was like buying tens of thousands of lottery tickets instead of a few hundred. Eventually, they discovered a previously undescribed class of molecules that looked promising, a process that took about 10 years. Ideally, one wants a drug that is highly selective, like Cinderella's glass slipper. It fits the intended target and not a whole range of feet, and potent. An early version of a sodium V1.8 blocker developed by Negulescu's team was selective and fairly potent. But in drug development, adverbs like fairly won't do. Years of optimization followed. When I asked Negulescu to explain what optimization was like day by day, he said, "Painful. It's iterative learning. There's the hypothesis. This is what we think would improve the potency of the molecule or the selectivity of it. Synthetic chemists then make the compounds they think might improve efficacy, and the lab team tests them quickly, within hours, then sends the data back to the synthetic chemists." I asked Negulescu how many compounds his team screened. "Hundreds of thousands," he said. Then he said it again. "Hundreds of thousands." Millions were screened to find the class of molecules, and then there were another 10,000 or so screenings done in the optimization process. Negulescu recalled encountering one of the chemists holding a tray in the hallway outside a lab. I asked him, "Are there some important compounds in there?" He looked at me and said, "Paul, they're all important." After more than 20 years, they had a potent and extremely selective compound called zuzetrigine, and it wasn't making people sick. The time had come to bring it to a large-scale clinical trial. Establishing a painkiller's efficacy is trickier than, for example, seeing whether a blood pressure drug is effective. There's a reason that the McGill pain questionnaire had 78 words. Todd Bertok ran the phase 3 clinical trials for zuzetrigine. "It's a very high bar in pain research to show effectiveness," Bertok said. "Some of the drugs don't reach that bar, not because they're not great drugs, but because the models are imperfect and our statistical approaches are imperfect. Terms like moderate and uncomfortable don't offer the precision of, say, 135 and 150. As Negulescu put it, there's no painometer. Two large-scale phase 3 clinical trials on zuzetrigine have been completed so far. One looked at 1,118 patients following an abdominoplasty, and another at 1,073 patients following a bunionectomy. Both are procedures after which people experience acute pain. Participants were given either zuzetrigine, Vicodin, or a placebo, and were monitored for 48 hours. A smaller trial looked at zuzetrigine versus a placebo in 202 patients with sciatica, a nerve pain. In the sciatica study, zuzetrigine worked about the same as the placebo. However, for the abdominoplasty and bunionectomy patients, zuzetrigine worked as well as Vicodin and better than a placebo. And more patients reported side effects on the placebo than on zuzetrigine. In January, zuzetrigine, under the name Zurnovex, became the first new non-opioid painkiller in more than 20 years to receive FDA approval for acute pain treatment. This has occasioned enormous celebration, which can at first glance be difficult to understand since the results seem modest. The comparison is to a relatively weak opioid, and it remains unclear if Zurnovex will be helpful with chronic pain, cancer pain, or neuropathic pain. Additionally, the drug costs $15 a pill. Insurance plans and assistance programs can lower the price, but it is still much more expensive than the pennies per pill option of a generic opioid. Yet, scientists working in pain research describe the underlying scientific achievement as a magisterial first step, just marvelous, and the holy grail. This proves the concept, Waxman told me. My expectation is that there may be next-generation medications that work even better. Painkillers that alleviate chronic and neuropathic pain are especially needed. A phase 3 clinical trial of suzetrigine for diabetic peripheral neuropathy is underway, and the FDA granted the drug a breakthrough therapy designation for the treatment of such pain, which should speed the drug's potential approval. I don't think there's a miracle drug that's going to replace opioids, and suzetrigine isn't that drug. But what we're doing is chipping away, Bertok said. Before suzetrigine, if acetaminophen and an NSAID were insufficient, my next step was a mild to moderate strength opioid. Now I can kick the opioid can down the road. Bertok said that early in his career, a mentor told him about opioids, that, quote, as long as someone had real pain, they can't become addicted. Obviously, that's been proven completely wrong, end quote. And the correction on opioid prescribing has precipitated a new problem, pain going undertreated or untreated. We need something else to fill that gap, Bertok said. We're not just talking about addiction. We're talking about people who are suffering and can't get the pain medicine they need. He went on, ultimately, I think we are going to be able to find a place where, if opioids are needed, it's going to be rare. In the laboratory, more compounds continue to be screened. We keep mining, Negulescu told me. It's never over. There's always more to learn, he said. He too sees suzetrigine as a kind of first step and believes that our future sodium V1.8 molecules will probably be even more potent. He and others are looking both at blocking sodium V1.7 and at combining the blocking of sodium V1.7 and sodium V1.8. Waxman has continued to follow his man-on-fire patients. He noticed something curious, which later proved revelatory. There were two mother-son pairs in which both mother and son had the same pain-causing sodium V1.7 genetic mutation, but the mother experienced much less pain than expected. The pain-resilient mothers, it turned out, had a further mutation, one that affected not a sodium channel, but a potassium channel. This new channel was involved in dampening pain signals. The mothers have one mutation that makes the neuron hyperactive and another that mutes it. So, in addition to sodium channels, which are the batteries that produce the signaling, we're looking at potassium channels, which are the brakes, Waxman said. Pain is not our enemy, Negulescu told me. We're not trying to get rid of pain, but we're trying to get rid of needless suffering. Woods had made a similar point in reflecting on his work with patients who can't feel pain. Pain has this great function. It allows you to understand what your body can and can't do. It allows you to learn how to modulate your activities and to become graceful. Melzack of the McGill Pain Questionnaire considered pain one of the most fascinating problems in psychology. In his book, The Puzzle of Pain, he thinks through mechanisms by which the mind might be doing its magical work of modulating pain signals. He gives the example of a football player who injures his shin while playing, but doesn't feel pain until later, when he takes off his sock in the locker room and sees blood. It's not mind over matter, it's mind and matter. And not all pain arrives as a message received from a peripheral pain-sensing nerve. More Die of Heartbreak is one of the few novels by Saul Bellow whose title doesn't include the main character's name or role, making it seem as if the central character is heartbreak itself. The only pain they ever suffer is emotional pain, which is interesting, Wood said to me, of his patients who feel no physical pain. That's one of the reasons he finds the diagnosis of congenital insensitivity to pain to be a bit misleading. They know what pain is, they just don't know what it is physically, he said. When Woods made this observation, it at first confused me. Emotional pain and physical pain appear so categorically different that it seems odd that we use the same word to describe them. And yet, the extent of the common language for emotional and physical pain is itself remarkable. Crushing sadness, pangs of guilt, wrenching news, the need for something to kill the pain. In thinking about why any given person becomes addicted to opioids, we aren't thinking only about pains for which we might first try extra-strength Tylenol. Edward Kessler writes in his poem, Pain, there are days when you wish your pain would hunker down on a toe or finger, some extremity you could do without, instead of wandering around the universe calling itself fancy names like angst. And now, from the financial page of the May 12, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, three faces of American capitalism, Buffett, Musk, and Trump. As the sage of Omaha announces his retirement, the Trump family's crypto ventures and Musk's Doge cuts illuminate darker aspects of the system. By John Cassidy. Last weekend, in Omaha, Nebraska, at the annual meeting of Warren Buffett's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, Buffett announced that at the end of this year, he will give up his post as CEO. According to reports, some people in the crowd cried at the news. Given that the attendees were nearly all Berkshire Hathaway shareholders, this reaction was perhaps unsurprising. If you bought $100 of Berkshire stock in 1964, just before Buffett took over the company, by the end of last year, it would have been worth roughly $5.5 million. But Buffett, who is 94 and frequently referred to as the sage of Omaha, isn't known only for his Midas touch. He's also famous for his relatively modest lifestyle, his call for higher taxes on the extremely wealthy, and his pledge to give away the great bulk of his fortune. If there is an acceptable face of American capitalism, many people would say that it's Buffett. The news of Buffett's impending departure comes at a time when some less public-minded representatives of the system are busy making headlines. As Buffett made his announcement, the Times and other news organizations were delving into the Trump family's latest crypto ventures. Just days later, Bill Gates, Buffett's longtime friend and partner in philanthropy, claimed that Elon Musk, the de facto head of the Department of Government Efficiency, had been responsible for the deaths of impoverished children by dismantling the U.S. Agency for International Development, which, among other services, provides HIV treatment and prevention drugs to kids in Africa. These developments set me thinking afresh about Thorsten Veblen, the eccentric but brilliant social theorist who features in my new book about critics of capitalism, which I've been researching and writing for much of the past decades. In The Theory of the Leisure Class, published in 1899, Veblen divided the capitalists of the first Gilded Age into two groups, the industrial class, hands-on entrepreneurs who walked the shop floors of their factories and were closely involved in the production process, and the pecuniary class, which included industrial moguls who owned many factories in absentia, along with investors, financiers, and others who made a lot of money simply by owning capital. The sixth of 12 children in a family of hard-working Midwestern farmers, Veblen held members of the pecuniary class in low esteem. He wrote, "Their office is of a parasitic nature, and their interest is to divert what substance they may to their own use and to retain whatever is under their hand." Veblen probably wouldn't have thought much of Buffett who built his fortune by studying the financial statements of companies to discover businesses that the stock market was undervaluing or that weren't being traded in the market at all. Based on this green eyeshade work, Buffett and his late partner, Charlie Munger, placed substantial investments in companies such as Apple, American Express, Coca-Cola, and Wells Fargo. As a conglomerate, Berkshire Hathaway also operates dozens of companies that it owns outright, including the insurer Geico, the railroads BNSF, and the fast food chain Dairy Queen. But it was big investments in Apple and other highly successful public companies that made Buffett one of the richest men in America. Currently, according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, he sits at number 6 with a net worth of $160 billion. Strictly speaking, then, Buffett is a member of Veblen's parasitic pecuniary class, whereas Musk, by dint of leading Tesla and SpaceX, could seemingly claim to be a member of the productive industrial class. But that isn't the full story. Musk is a highly successful entrepreneur, but he has also profited enormously from investors bidding Tesla stock into the stratosphere. Moreover, his companies have benefited from tens of billions of dollars in federal contracts. Viewed from this perspective, Musk is also a member of Veblen's pecuniary class. This contradiction illuminates the limits of using a century-old framework to interpret a new Gilded Age economy, in which industry, finance, and the government are so intertwined that it's sometimes difficult to discern their boundaries. And yet, there is still something powerful about Veblen's taxonomy. When pecuniary capitalism comes to predominate, he pointed out in another book, The Theory of Business Enterprise, values such as a sense of equity, fair dealing, and workmanlike integrity get cast aside in favor of anything that facilitates quick scores. This code of business ethics consists, after all, of mitigations of the maxim caveat emptor, Veblen noted. Caveat emptor, the maxim buyer beware, certainly applies to some of the latest Trump family crypto schemes, which have included partnering in World Liberty Financial, a new firm that fashions itself as an all-purpose crypto company, and issuing their own cryptocurrency, the Dollar Trump meme coin, whose market value has gyrated wildly. But to fully comprehend the Trump 2.0 business model, you have to supplement the principle of caveat emptor with an understanding of how crony capitalism operates in the crypto age. According to the Times, World Liberty Financial has approached other crypto firms and asked them to pay handsomely for the privilege of being associated with the Trump name. Last month, in an even more brazen venture, a website associated with Dollar Trump offered the top 220 holders of the digital asset an, quote, intimate private dinner, end quote, with the president at his golf club in Washington. The website said that the top 25 holders would also get to attend a private VIP reception with Trump and receive a special VIP tour. This is really incredible, Corey Frager, the director of investor protection at the Consumer Federation of America, told the Times. They are making the pay-to-play deal explicit. Berkshire Hathaway has been fined for regulatory violations, but it has not been embroiled in any major scandals. Unlike many Wall Street investors, the company tends to hold on to its investments for years or even decades. In 2008, it paid $230 million for a 10% stake in a Chinese electric vehicle company called BYD. Earlier this year, BYD overtook Tesla in global sales. Berkshire's stake is now worth billions of dollars, even after it has recently sold some shares. As well as preaching and demonstrating patience in investing, Buffett has led the way in promoting charitable giving by members of the 0.001%. In 2006, he announced his intention to gradually donate virtually all his Berkshire stock to philanthropic organizations. So far, his donations have amounted to about $60 billion. And in 2010, Buffett joined with Bill and Melinda Gates to launch the Giving Pledge, in which signatories promised to give away more than half their fortunes during their lives or in their wills. As of last month, more than 200 very rich people in 30 countries had signed the pledge. Philanthropic giving by billionaires certainly won't cure all the ills of capitalism, but it's surely preferable to an alternative in which they hoard their vast riches and, at death, exploit lax tax laws to pass them on to their heirs largely intact. Buffett recognized this, and he has also displayed an appreciation uncommon among billionaires for how the vagaries of fortune have favored him. In a 2010 magazine article, he wrote the following: "My wealth has come from a combination of living in America, some lucky genes, and compound interest. Both my children and I won what I call the ovarian lottery. For starters, the odds against my 1930 birth taking place in the U.S. were at least 30 to 1. My being male and white also removed huge obstacles that a majority of Americans then faced. I've worked in an economy that rewards someone who saves the lives of others on a battlefield with a medal, rewards a great teacher with thank you notes from parents, but rewards those who can detect the mispricing of securities with sums reaching into the billions. In short, fate's distribution of long straws is wildly capricious." In keeping with this view of the world, Buffett has long decried the fact that, because of the way in which the federal tax system is structured, his effective tax rate is lower than his secretary's. In 2012, the Obama White House took this observation and made it the basis of the Buffett Rule, which the administration defined as the basic principle that no household making over $1 million annually should pay a smaller share of their income in taxes than middle-class families pay. Scandalously, many billionaires still manage to get away with paying precious little federal income tax. Trump famously bragged about this on the debate stage with Hillary Clinton in 2016. By contrast, Berkshire Hathaway is now so large and profitable that even though the corporate tax rate is just 21%, it makes very large federal tax payments. Last year, the sum was $26.8 billion. In his annual letter to Berkshire's stockholders, Buffett pointed out that this was about 5% of the total tax payments made by all of corporate America. "Someday your nieces and nephews at Berkshire hope to send you even larger payments than we did in 2024, he wrote. "Spend it wisely. Take care of the many who, for no fault of their own, get the short straws in life. They deserve better." When Buffett signed this letter in February, Musk and Doge, in Trump's name, were already dismantling USAID and other government departments. As Gates noted in an interview with the Financial Times, "The picture of the world's richest man killing the world's poorest children is not a pretty one." But it wouldn't have surprised the uber-skeptic Veblen, and neither would the self-dealing ventures of the Trumps. In discussing the rise of the pecuniary class, Veblen compared its members to street delinquents at the opposite pole of society. "The ideal pecuniary man," he wrote, "is like the ideal delinquent in his unscrupulous conversion of goods and persons to his own ends, and in a callous disregard of the feelings and wishes of others and of the remoter effects of his actions." Does that remind you of anybody? And now, from the May 27, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, "Donald Trump's war on gender is also a war on government. By forcing rigid definitions of sex across all federal agencies, Republicans are undermining the administrative state's capacity to protect public health and safety. By Paisley Cura. Amid Donald Trump's recent attacks on transgender people, many critics of his administration have cited the German pastor Martin Niemöller, whose 1946 poem, First They Came, describes Nazi Germany's progressive targeting of maligned groups. Indeed, on the first day of Trump's second term, he signed an anti-trans executive order decreeing that the federal government recognize only two sexes, male and female. Since then, his administration's pursuit of groups that it deems enemies, immigrants, college protesters, white shoe law firms, has progressed rapidly. But Trump's anti-trans actions are not just opening moves in a battle against vulnerable groups, nor are they simply fanning the flames of right-wing moral panic. The push to eradicate so-called woke gender ideology is also a part of the assault on the government itself. The right understands this. It's time the left did too. The administrative state, a term thrown around with much derision in conservative circles, is simply a label for what the government does to keep America running. In fulfilling its duty to attend to the health, safety, and welfare of the population, the state builds roads, regulates toxins, records deeds, issues identity documents, and studies birth, death, and disease. Whether passed by Congress or state legislatures, laws cannot specify all the minutiae involved in protecting the health and safety of the people. If a state legislature passes a law requiring its restaurants to maintain safe and sanitary conditions, its members are not sitting around deciding the correct food storage temperatures. Executive agencies exist, in large part, to make such determinations. Since the New Deal, they have developed tools, forms, protocols, expert reviews, and rules and regulations to achieve goals set by legislatures. To implement broad legislative mandates, administrative agencies must create systems that categorize information about the public they serve, breaking down the population into discrete categories based on whatever classifications best support a particular purpose. A person's identity can be sorted many ways, depending on the context. By age, marital status, income, occupation, residency status, parental status, and more. These categories aren't timeless ontological judgments. They're practical tools that help the government fulfill its duties. One of those criteria is sex. Administrative agencies have often defined sex not to fit large philosophies about gender, but to help themselves do their job. Sometimes agencies' decisions help trans people, sometimes they don't. But there is usually an underlying rationale that calibrates a particular definition of sex to an agency's purpose. In other words, when it comes to governing, sex is not an input with a predefined meaning determining the state's rules. It's an output, a creation of those rules, reverse-engineered to fit what an agency needs sex to do. When senators tried to bait Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson at her confirmation hearing into offering up a strict definition of woman, she gave the answer anyone familiar with sex in the administrative state would give. If there's a dispute about a definition, people make arguments, and I look at the law, and I decide. Trump's executive order, titled Defending Women from Gender Ideology Extremism and Restoring Biological Truth to the Federal Government, instead declares that sex is binary and immutable, grounded in fundamental and incontrovertible reality. Female means a person belonging at conception to the sex that produces the large reproductive cell. Males belong at conception to the sex that produces the small one. That definition, nonsensical because there are no distinguishable reproductive cells at conception, applies to all agencies and programs of the federal government. A deluge of policy reversals has followed. The administration prohibited trans girls and trans women from participating in women's sports, banned transgender people from serving in the military, reverted to putting sex at birth on federal identity documents, tried to transfer trans women to men's prisons, and began requiring federal employees to use the bathrooms aligned with their birth sex, among other actions. Gender was replaced with sex on federal forms, and references to trans people on federal websites, including the National Park Service's page about the Stonewall Uprising, were removed. Trump's Defending Women order doesn't just erase transgender people. Along with the administration's attack on DEI initiatives, it signals that the concept of gender itself has become a chief target. It is nearly impossible to study disparities in health outcomes without studying the social, cultural, and psychological traits that typically fall under the banner of gender. During the first year of the pandemic, for instance, more men than women were dying of COVID-19, and news organizations were quick to point to biological sex differences as the cause. But when researchers from the Gender Sci Lab at Harvard combed through the data, they pointed out that gender-related social factors could also play a significant role. How else to account for the fact that men were more likely to die of COVID-19 than women in New York, but not in Connecticut? If the administration forces various agencies to excise gender from the study of health, the government won't be able to gather the evidence needed to justify policies that would benefit a wide range of people, including, in the case of COVID, men. To say that Trump's executive order is a wrecking ball is to vastly understate its scope and impact. Wrecking balls follow an arc. Trump's order is like a tornado, crashing unpredictably into departments, reports, standards, forms, and now scientific practice. The goal appears to be not just making villains out of gender and sexual minorities, but by dismantling the health, safety, and welfare infrastructure of the administrative apparatus, targeting the same women that Trump's Defending Women purports to protect. Much of what the administrative state does is mundane. But if basic indices of public health and safety cannot be measured accurately, if agencies cannot do the work they're chartered to do, the part of the state that attends to the health and well-being of the population withers. That may be the point. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.